Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru. Welcome to our next episode of our podcast about the autobiography of a yogi. We're going through it line by line. We're here with Priyank and Lauren. Chris couldn't make it today. There's special news about Lauren today. What happened recently to you?
Listeners have to guess. Oh. Give us your best guesses and then
pause here.
Pause, yes. Guess.
What could have happened?
And type your responses. Go on, Lauren, tell us.
I was very blessed. I got my Kriya last Saturday. No, Saturday before that at the Mother Center. So
great. Amazing. Blessings. Mike, were you there?
I was not in the same Kriya ceremony. I was there. I actually dropped off another friend who also got Kriya. That same day
delivering,
but you would have had to sign up very early, and I think they say you can only do it once per life to do it at Mother Center or something. So yeah, Lauren, very special, Lauren,
very blessed. Lauren, yeah. We had initiation in London earlier this year, and Lauren's like, no, not going to this one.
Well, I wasn't allowed to.
I see.
We knew she had something up her sleeve. We knew she wanted to leave in the past.
Definitely not. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. No, this is amazing. Congratulations.
Amazing.
And we are in a special chapter as well, in the chapter 10, where Guruji meets his guru. We're not quite there yet. We know that he's going to meet his guru from the title of the chapter already. But first he's going through some other steps. So he joined an ashram. He joined an ashram with Swami. His name is Dayananda, and I don't know how he came to choose this ashram. I think one of the reasons might have been that it's not in his hometown. It is actually in a town that has many different names. I think it's called Varanasi now. In the autobiography, they call it Benares often, and then Guruji calls it Kashi. And yeah, it's a place we talked about it in the podcast about the movie Awake a lot, because it's famous for its burning gods, right?
I hope to be there in 6 weeks.
Oh yeah, okay, nice. Okay.
I'll report back.
That's great. Yeah, I've actually never been there, but I think it must be in some ways a magical place. So the section where we start off is where he has arrived at the ashram, and he says, I was pleased that my new home possessed an attic where I managed to spend the dawn and morning hours. And of course we know what he would do there, the dawn and morning hours. He would meditate there. And that, I think attics are kind of very useful for that, because you're on your own. And Guruji also had an attic in his own home, right, where he would sit and meditate. So it's like familiar setting for him. But then comes the first kind of message that where he has something to comment on. But first, Priyank.
Yeah, like those comments are about his practices. But he said that in his meditate, that he used to spend his morning, the dawn and morning hours during doing his, you know, in this attic room, which would imply that it's going to be at least a 3-hour meditation every single morning. So we were discussing, I think you guys were discussing long meditations, weren't you, before this, before we started the call. And we were saying, oh, the, you know, 3 hours long is usually like tomorrow I'm leading one at the center, and that's 3 hours long, the weekly long haul. But your Guruji was at that age seemed to be, you've been doing every morning.
Yes, very different standards. For me, 3 hours is a long meditation. For him, it's what he does in the morning, every morning.
Yeah, I've got to get it. I've got, when I do that long, I've got to really G myself up. Otherwise, it will be torture after 90 minutes. I'm like, what am I going to do for the next hour? But yeah, if I get, you know, really get myself in the mood or whatever, then I can do it the whole day.
And it's holiday season, so we got the 8-hour meditation coming up. Gonna have one at Lake Shrine in 2 weeks. So
nice.
Looking forward to that one. So his first comment he makes that is slightly critical. He goes like, the ashram members, they knew little about meditation practices, which is surprising, right? I would have thought he goes to an ashram and then in the expectation to find God and meditate with other ashram, I almost said inmates, but ashram members, but it wasn't like that. Yeah, Priyank?
Yeah, we discussed this, Chris and I discussed this last time, his reasons for kind of leaving. Mm-hmm. So the hermitage is called Bharat Dharma Mahamandal. And one of the reasons for joining that organization, one of its purposes is to reestablish Sanatan Dharma, which is like the core precepts of Hinduism. So not necessarily Kriya practice, right? That's just one facet of Hinduism, but the Hindu way of life and education and the arts and all those other things that are you know, part of it. So this is true for many paths in Hinduism. Like if you go to ISKCON temple, they may do the chanting, but you won't ever see them doing asanas, which is like hatha yoga. You'll never see them. You'll rarely see them doing any pranayama or anything. Lots of organizations don't know much about the actual esoteric meditation practices, even though, you know, it's in most of our scriptures. It's just not, maybe it's too difficult for some paths to kind of grasp it, or not even grasp it, to commit to it, because it is quite a commitment, isn't it? It's not like, oh, you can just do it willy-nilly. You have to, as I was mentioning, to do a 3-hour meditation, you've got to really be up for it, otherwise it is torture.
So instead they encouraged Mukunda to engage in organizational duties, which is I would say it's definitely a change of pace for what he was doing before when he lived at home. And also one of the things that I wanted to bring up, but let first Lauren.
Oh no, it's okay, you can carry on.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about work-life balance and the spiritual and work balance, how important that is. Guruji emphasizes this often, that because a lot of people are coming onto the path with a lot of spiritual motivation, I would say, and they then would like to spend a lot of time meditating. And Guruji, the counsel to a lot of people is also by monks, is no, you just live, you work your job, you do everything right, you try to abide by the yamas and niyamas, and then you add meditation to your mix, to your life, and then it will slowly spiritualize. And so I don't want to disregard completely that those organizational duties that they brought up here. Yeah, Lauren?
Yeah, and going off from that, what I found interesting was that Guruji writes that they thought he should employ his whole time. So it's not just like, oh, can you commit? It's like all of his time they would like him to spend on the organization, which is, you know, not so balanced after all, is it? So I can understand why he felt a little bit put out by that.
And also the organizational work is like it's like the karma yoga path, you know, dedicating your, you know, actions in you know, without being attached to fruits, just doing it for God and gurus. That's one surefire, quite easy path towards your liberation. But as Mike said, yeah, we don't need to do that entirely. One of the cards I got, you know, those SRF, like you get these like little printed cards with Guruji's pictures on them, and a little inspirational quote. And one of them, it says, life should be chiefly service. It says chiefly service, but not only service, right? Yeah. You have to employ, give yourself time for solitude. Mm-hmm. One of the other quotes in the Gita is, to establish yourself, you need some solitude to establish mm-hmm. yourself, you know, in the self. So you need to, you know, give yourself time for meditative and other practices that are purely mm-hmm. about you mm-hmm. and your own liberation.
Yeah, those are really good points, because as we see later on, Guruji and in the hermitage of Sri Yukteswar, he does a lot of service, right? So it's not about not doing service, it's about this balance, and it's about the supreme goal that he doesn't want to lose sight of, the finding God. And he has a clear vision of how he's going to do that, and it's clearly by a strong meditation practice and by a God-realized master that guides him there. That's kind of his requirements for an ashram. Then he gets some interesting comment from one of his fellows there at the ashram, at Dayananda's ashram. He says, "Don't try to catch God so soon," which is that must be disturbing, because that's diametrically opposed to what Mukunda wants, right? It's like, no, that's exactly what I want. I want to catch him as soon as I can. Of course, they say that, I guess, is that a passive-aggressive comment towards him, that because he spends too much time in the attic? I guess that's how I understood that. But of course, as Mukunda, when you hear that, you go like, what am I even doing in this place? I get comments like this.
Yeah, the previous line was they gave him praise for the afternoon work in the office. So it's like, you know, when someone gives you false praise, it's just praise essentially to get what they want out of you, rather than for your ultimate, or, you know, your everyone's good. So but obviously they're trying to keep him in line. That's one way of doing it, the praise way. But here, this is actually, like, I think Mike's absolutely right, this passive aggressive kind of, you know, undertones of ridicule. It's quite mean, I think, when people talk about the spiritual, you know, sadhana that you're obviously doing sincerely and that you have faith in, etc. And then if someone says words like this, it kind of belittles what you're doing, doesn't it? So I can't imagine, if I'd heard that, I wouldn't have been too happy. And I've got, you know, I've got even friends that often make a joke out of this kind of thing in my life. They'd be like, you know, if I try not to do something immoral, but that everyone's doing, that's just not even a big deal. But I'd just do it, and then they'd be like, "Oh, Gandhi's at it again," and I'm like, "Oh gosh, why do we have to go to this level?" But yeah, I think it's part of it is like this banter culture, isn't it? But here in the ashram, it seems to be there. But I don't. Whenever I get it, I don't take it. I'll be like, "Do you know who Gandhi is? You're just rolling his name off just freely." And similarly, if they say like something about yoga or something, I try and say, you know, these are the most profound aspects of a life that you're just mocking, essentially. So, it doesn't make me too popular, I must say.
that reminds me of a story that Brother Govindananda told. I think that must have been 15 years ago, when he was a brahmachari and he came to Vienna, and he said, he was like, he had just finished college or something, and his first job was on an oil rig. And his job was he was like an engineer on an oil rig, and that the main engineer that was usually there, he was sick, so he was like the only one who had any technical knowledge there, and they needed to move this oil rig from Ireland all the way to like somewhere in Asia. And there were loads of problems all the time. and then he said for him this was a real growing experience dealing with those people. And he said at some point when he just decided that when his peace of mind was gone and he couldn't make a clear decision, he would just lock himself. He had this kind of cockpit area. He would lock himself in there and meditate. And then people were screaming at him, and he said that the tone was pretty rough there, and he just didn't care. And the people would say something similar as what you just mentioned. It's like, yeah, the yogi is meditating again. It's like, what can we do? Yeah. So I guess Guruji might have used meditation as well as a way to deal with life at this ashram, which might not have been exactly what he was imagining it to be. So that's, and meditation is great for that. It gives you inner peace, inner joy, right? So makes it much easier to deal with difficult circumstances. But yeah, this rebuke ruffled Mukunda, right? When he said, don't catch God so soon, and he gets ridiculed for it. So then he goes, he confronts Dayananda. He confronts him and he tells him clearly, I'm here to find God. I'm going to read what he actually said. He said, I don't understand what is required of me here. I'm seeking direct perception of God. Without him, I cannot be satisfied with affiliation or creed or performance of good works. Priyank?
The three really sounding words, they're almost like synonyms, aren't they? But they, I just did like some dictionary, and they've got very different tranches of meaning. So like the affiliation element, I think he was referring to, you know, just if you're part of a religious group that's got a lot of reputation, then, you know, some people would just be satisfied with that. Oh, I'm a brahmachari or I'm a swami. You know, that is the kind of affiliation that he's not after. He's not just after some surface level association. So he's not satisfied with merely affiliation. Then he says he's not satisfied with creed. And creed is, you know, having a belief in a philosophy or a way of life and all the things that are associated with that belief. So he's not happy with just having the creed. And then he said he's also not happy with just the performance of good works, i.e. the karma yoga being, you know, the highest aim, but not the only aim in his life. He wants to have direct perception of God, as he said in the previous sentence, which for to do karma yoga, then you're playing the long haul. It's the long haul. We have a lot of karma to burn, but he's not happy with just relying on that element. And of course, Kriya is the ultimate way of burning karma, as Lauren now fully is aware of.
So I don't really understand that next, what happens after this, because there are a few things to build up, right? So Guruji chose Dayananda's ashram. So clearly Guruji must have been impressed with Dayananda in some way. Must have been impressed with him spiritually. And now Guruji makes this really clear statement. He cannot be satisfied by anything else. And I feel like he couldn't have been any more direct. He basically says, I don't care about any of this. Just being, there might be people here that are impressed with to the point that just being a member of this ashram gives them enough street cred that they're happy and stuff. But I'm not. I'm actually looking for perception of God. And then Dayananda, he must have been a person of some higher realization. I don't know exactly what the details are there. But I would have thought if Master Mahashaya would have been confronted like that, he would have been open, right? He would have told him either, like Master Mahashaya said, told him, I'm not your guru, right? But Dayananda doesn't say that at all. Dayananda just tries to calm him down. He says, he scolds people. He tells them, leave Mukunda alone. And then he says, he will learn our ways. And I'm not really sure why he thinks this is a good idea. He probably thinks highly of Mukunda and wants to keep him in the ashram. That seems to be clear, but I don't understand why he thinks this is going to work. Yeah, Lauren?
That bit stood out to me as well, because when he says he will learn our ways, that to me is very telling. It's not like, oh, he'll learn the truth. It's, oh, he'll learn how we do things, you know, which is very different, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely a red flag, as the modern-day people would call it.
Yeah, it's the affiliation element, isn't it? And Guruji called it out straight away in the thing. He's not seeking just to learn how people do things. He wants the ultimate. He wants to be the ultimate person, right? Or have the ultimate relationship with God. And a couple of sentences later, he says the students weren't noticeably bent on their chastisement. So clearly it's a game, isn't it? You know, when you're in school and someone's doing something naughty and the teacher can't really be bothered to make a big deal about it. So they just mock tell someone off, and everyone, the person being told off, knows it's not really true. The teacher knows it's not really true. Everyone else in the classroom knows it's not really true, but everyone plays along. But Mukunda is not of that ilk, is he?
So in school, you have an environment that is like, I would say, forced a bit, because you as a student, you have to go to school and abide by a teacher. Mukunda at this point is an adult, right? So Mukunda, I would have thought after this, he would have just walked, but he didn't. He stays, he says I politely concealed my doubt, right? So that also means that Mukunda isn't, he wants this to work out. I think one of the reasons might also be he kind of went all in on Dayananda. He left his home. He moved to another city, and what we will see later is that he wishes this to be a success also in the eyes of his family later on. Yeah, Priyank?
So this whole episode in this hermitage, it feels like it's a life-changing commitment, doesn't it? But obviously it turns out not to be the case. But it's actually only a page in the autobiography of Yoga, his life in this ashram, one or two pages, and this the statement of I politely concealed my doubt is the red flag is obviously acknowledged by Mukunda, and this is the beginning of the end of this aforementioned affiliation, isn't it? So he's just going to chug along now and look for signs about what to do next, essentially, I think.
Yeah, and then, like you mentioned earlier, Priyank, the students were not very impressed with being scolded by by Swami Dayananda. And then Dayananda has some more comments from Mukunda. He says, I see that your dad keeps sending you money. And I think you won't need money here. You're to be a fully committed member of this ashram. You can be self-sufficient, and there shouldn't be money from the outside. And one reason might be that he saw Mukunda was acting up. Maybe Mukunda felt very independent, and maybe this was one of the ways to kind of curb his independence a little bit, get him in line. That's kind of one of my theories.
Yeah, and he's sensed that Mukunda is not committing his heart to mm-hmm. the place, right? And so mm-hmm. he would have no doubt been like picking away at various facets of his psyche, i.e. his mm-hmm. he must know that he comes from a quite a wealthy, not wealthy, you know, mm-hmm. upper middle class family of that has doesn't have money problems. So mm-hmm. He is trying to pick at that, because one of the vows that renunciants have to take is to forego personal wealth. This is the start. And I think there's two lessons, I think, in this whole Dayananda one or two pages. And this is one of them, the importance of brahmacharya, i.e. non-attachment and not relying on money for your health and well-being, and committing to things without the element of having money in mind. And the second we're going to talk about a bit later, probably in the next episode, but it's about mastery over diet and food and taste buds and things like that. So I think these two elements are really, really good lessons from Dayananda.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And so, like you mentioned it already, Priyank, but yeah, so this is the first part of it is him sending his money back. That's kind of cuts a little bit of Mukunda's independence and will probably force him more to abide by ashram rules, because now you don't want to hit the hand that feeds you, right? So you probably will have a stronger commitment, or Mukunda will. And I think this is at least a theory that Dayananda has. Mukunda, however, we know already is very strong-willed, and he's not going to be coerced by anyone into anything. So, but then he's also patient, and I really think this is also a lesson to when you see something and you feel like this there's a red flag, like Lauren mentioned earlier, or there's like something not right. He still wants to know the whole thing. He wants to know the whole deal, and he really goes all in, at least for a bit, to see, until he really reaches the point where he says, okay, I can't do this anymore. This is too much. Right. And yeah.
The other thing that I was gonna say was that his father is his father's still sending him money. How cute is that though, isn't it? Because he knows that Mukunda, he knows that he's going to be a renunciant. But it's like letting a bird, you know, that's himself made himself outcast, but you're still trying to, you know, make sure that he is well fed and all that kind of stuff. But Mukunda chose to leave, but father is still playing the role of the father. And, you know, there's no resentment, there's no anger, there's just unconditional love, isn't there? Because often, you know, when people have wealthy parents have arguments with their children, if they, you know, disown them and disrespect them in this way, that's it. You know, even if they're wealthy, you're not getting a single pound, a single dollar from me anymore. You've learned to make it on your own, but there's nothing of that sort from the father.
Is it maybe a difference between Eastern and Western style of raising children as well? That I feel like in the East, you kind of care, you try to support your children more if you can. I mean, and Mukunda's father was pretty wealthy so he was clearly able. And I would bet that Mukunda wasn't his most expensive son.
Don't know. He was starting libraries and meditation clubs and schools and all that kind of stuff, wasn't he? It must not have been cheap. And giving his money away to charity and never know.
Like his mother.
Yes. Yeah. But I if I would bet, I would think Ananta, he had like some very You had some very big material dreams that needed to be manifested. That I'm sure it cost money. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing he was glad he could be in some ways. I think his father, more than Ananta, was always somehow satisfied with Mukunda's spirituality. He still wanted to guide him towards a materially stable life, but he was always very much impressed with his spiritual inclination, I think. And so I don't think, like, you don't see many, you do see that he wants Mukunda close to him, but you almost never see that he would like to abandon Mukunda or anything like that for his ways, right? So seems to be a very loving father.
Mm. You mentioned Mukunda not being the most expensive child. Do you think it could have been, who was the bodybuilder? Was it Bishnu? Was it Bishnu Charan Ghosh?
Right. Yeah.
So maybe he had loads of like protein orders.
Yeah.
build that muscle.
Yeah, to build. He said, "Dad, can you build me a gym in the garage?" for sure. And then, in an Indian family, when you have daughters, you have to, this also goes with financial transactions, like, when they get married. And so part two of coercing Mukunda is, I don't know if that's actually a thing that is conscious by Dayananda. That is just the way of life in the ashram that Mukunda finds hard to adjust to, is that food is not as available as Mukunda is used to. So he says he grew up in his family home. They had a family cook, which sounds amazing. And then when he woke up in the morning, he went to the kitchen and told the cook to prepare breakfast. And he was already annoyed if it came 10 minutes late. But now it's very different. Now they have breakfast 3 hours later than Mukunda is used to. And you would think after a while he kind of adjusts to that, gets used to it. But he says, no, every day those 3 hours were harder to endure. I don't know. I find it funny because maybe I can relate to this. Or Mukunda is this kind of yogi that has this amazing willpower, but this is what gets him. I found that very, very fun to read. Yeah.
Yeah. This this line, even when you feel hunger, do not mention it. I feel like this is like a really good lesson for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know we do the positive, use affirmations in a positive way, but you can also probably use affirmations negatively as well. So you keep saying you're hungry, you keep saying there's not enough food, then that's going to manifest, isn't it? So he's saying essentially, don't say anything that you don't want in your life, if that makes any sense, because you'll be the cause of your own downfall, right? So if food's not available, or you know you're not getting your next meal till tomorrow, then you can't be looking at cookbooks and YouTube videos of like how to your most favored foods and things like that.
I do that. whenever
that's
I fast,
to test yourself, isn't it, Mike?
On a fasting day, I don't know why YouTube knows when I'm fasting, and then it shows me all those food videos.
It's testing you, Mike.
Yes.
I had an experience on the plane going to America. I don't eat nuts. The body is supposedly allergic. So I took a sandwich because I thought, well, you know, just be a little bit prepared. It was 11-hour straight flight, right? So I get on board and it turns out that I can't have anything because they're all too terrified, which is okay. I thought, all right then. Well, you know, here's what it is. And I think because I'd you know, fasted before and, you know, done that regularly, you could use that willpower. But like, it's true, isn't it? It's like when you know you can't eat, the last thing you want to do is think about food. So I literally had my Bhagavad Gita on the plane. I was just like intently reading it the entire flight almost. Because yeah, you got to put your mind on something else. It's true.
That's right. It's not easy. I feel like I sometimes I thought that the body and the mind are two entities that they act separately. So the body, something hurts, that's fine, but I can put my mind somewhere else. But I feel like when I feel hunger, body and mind, they gang up on me together. The body keeps feeling famished, and the mind put all those thoughts of food in my mind all the time. So it's very difficult.
Did you guys also find this paragraph funny, i.e., where the famishment gleamed in my eye, I knew not that I was hungry, I knew only too well. It's just so good. The English is just too good. And then and then he says he'd been accustomed to a large meal, you know, at 9 o'clock. For many of us, that's quite difficult to imagine. But Indian breakfasts can be exceptionally heavy. So the food that he's talking about would be things like puri, which is like a fried bread, puffed fried bread. And then you'd have things like chickpeas and dal and things with the puri, yogurt perhaps, or like a paratha, like a very thick stuffed paratha, which is also had in Bengal. So all these quite heavy, quite oily foods and vegetables and high in protein things, that this is what he's talking about. And if he's used to having that at 9 o'clock, and then not having that at nine is a very, 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 very big change. Because I remember a similar thing up to the age of probably 21, I'd have my breakfast was like four or six slices of toast and cereal. Yeah, I
Wow.
know.
My gosh.
And then I made the switch, and then for the first few weeks, I found it really hard because you're not getting your, you know, at seven or eight when I used to eat, I wouldn't have this huge intake of food. But now I can't think of having such a heavy meal at that time because, yeah, as Lauren and Mike both know, that's I've replaced that with fruits and other things like that. So if I'm going to have anything like that, it's after 12, which is what he's doing here in this ashram. So it just takes some time to get used to different style of not style, different timings, and your body will adjust, and it'll feel a lot better for it if you follow these injunctions.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that Guruji would have no problem with his kind of demonstrated mental strength. However, he, like you said, Priyank, the way he describes it is very dramatic, which I really found this entertaining. And but he goes like from this person who finds it really hard to not have a 9 o'clock breakfast to something that is he finds I need to get my palate under control. So he goes from that to a 24-hour fast. And that's also not the what the average person would do, right? Like, I mean, the average person would kind of try to somehow manage to get through the day or try to cheat or something, but he goes completely the other direction. He says, I can do a 24-hour fast. Funny enough, there's like this is kind of how far we're gonna read the chapter today, but this 24-hour fast story continues after this in a funny way. Yeah, Lauren.
It's also a subtle nod to discernment as well, isn't it? Because, you know, the first thing that is said to him, he inwardly feels like, no, that's not quite right. But this he fully takes on board. and with good reason as well, as we know. But
I was just gonna also mention there's another funny line that we missed, which was gone with the Calcutta years when I could rebuke the cook for a 10-minute delay. Poor cook in that household.
I know.
There's like so many people in the house, and then the 10-minute delay may not even been his.
Where's my food? Yes.
Where's my fifth and sixth slice of bread? That's what would have been for me.
Where's my paratha? Yeah.
Lauren, what are you going
to say? It's a little bit relatable because most people have probably been through a circumstance where they're really hungry, they want their dinner, and they go to their parent or caregiver or whoever, and you know, when's dinner, and you know, all of this, and it kind of feels a bit like that, doesn't it? Just on a bit more of a grand scale.
I also, he says, that I, you know, I try to control my appetite by doing a 24-hour fast, and I remember. Cool. Similarly, doing when I first started fasting, I did a 1-day fast, and in my mind it was 24 hours exactly as he's written it, 24 hours, not one day. And I remember waking up in the, you know, six waking up in the early hours to like make sure that I ate, so that
food waiting for you,
I wouldn't die. That's what I thought. Yeah, can't go over this by, you know, I need to just make sure that I survive this fast. So I used to follow the 24-hour rule to the T. Thankfully, it's not so difficult now. So because if you do a 1-day fast now, if your last meal is say 6 o'clock, then you wouldn't be eating till, you know, the next day you fasted. Then the following morning, you won't eat early in the morning. We'll be doing our practices, right? So you probably won't eat till 9 or 10 a.m. So that's like a 40-hour fast, isn't it, really? Doing a 1-day fast is 40 hours.
But that's how it should be, right?
Yeah.
Because I feel like the 24-hour fast makes no sense, because for me, it's really what you need is you need to sleep, wake up, have a whole day without eating, and then sleep and wake up again. I feel like that's a real 1-day fast. If I eat in a day, then it becomes very easy to do. Because I mostly have only one or two meals per day anyways. So that's,
Yeah, but you're a lean, mean fighting machine. What are the rest of
fighting machine? I like that. Yeah. but it's really when you go beyond what's comfortable, I feel like that's when the body really makes adjustments and heals. And Guruji writes a lot about the positive effect of fasting on the body, the kind of energy that the body constantly needs to digest food is suddenly freed up and is available to heal other parts of the body, which is very healing. And he suggests doing it regularly. So he's come a long way from growing up in his childhood home to being a guru who suggests to fast once a week. Yeah.
Regularly, indeed. One day a week, he says, on was it ground nuts and orange juice, and also two or three days in consecutive days in a month. So that's pretty intense. And then he says in like the service that Sunday, remember I read a Thursday service on fasting as well, and he says that this will scrub every cell in your body. And and a Japanese scientist won a Nobel Prize just on this very topic, didn't he? Actually probably a decade ago now, about the efficacy of this and regenerating stem cells, things like that. And also, I don't know if you guys do it, but I find it really, really useful doing it 1 day a week.
Yes,
I used to. I do maybe 1 day a month now, but I still find it very beneficial because it also resets my habits a little bit. After a day of fasting, I find it a lot easier to then start the day up after that and kind of, that's actually not true. The day after fasting, I usually have a big breakfast, but then the rest of the week, it kind of becomes easier to kind of, because I feel like the body is this kind of like Shri Teshwar think says that the body's a treacherous friend, give him its due, right? And no more. And no, I feel like the body always wants a little bit more, a little bit more all the time. So at some point you need to push the reset button and say, okay, let's, how about a bit less now?
Yeah. That's the goal of the evolutionary process, isn't it? To have more than you need, and hence you'll then store some fat. And then in times of scarcity, when food is sparse in the evolutionary process, then you will have some reserves. So we're designed to eat more than we need. Like the feeling of hunger lags, the feeling of feeling full, like, takes a while. Even though you might actually be full, the feeling comes like, what, 30 minutes later, doesn't it? And then by then you've overeaten. So yeah. Guruji advises us that we leave the table slightly hungry, doesn't he?
Slightly
he
hungry, yeah.
And if we just followed that, then none of these fad diets would need to be so prominent in the media. And
he talks like he talks often about the really negative effects of overeating, just doing it once or even doing it regularly. So leaving the table a little bit hungry is an excellent way to live life.
A couple of days ago, my wife left me dinner, and she's in India right now. So she left me dinner for a couple of days ago, and it was way too much. And I was like, oh gosh, this is it's not gonna last, so I need to finish this. But that was like the worst mistake. So I ate too much. Was that yesterday? No, Lauren, it was yesterday when I met you yesterday.
Oh.
I was so full. And I was going for the Thursday evening meditation, and Brother Vishwananda was leading, not leading, he was there after the service to talk about some things with the congregation. And so like I thought I'd left enough time, 4 hours I'd left between that meal and the long meditation period, but it was not long enough. Like my energy was, there was so much energy being used in whatever was happening in my stomach, the digestion process, that it was just such a struggle to bring my awareness up to the higher chakras. It's just it's just so bad for meditation, overeating. So the next time, I hate wasting food, but I'm gonna have to waste food from now on, because this is worse.
Just freeze it.
It is worse. Your body's a temple.
Yeah. It is. Yeah.
Yes.
It's true.
Absolutely. So we have come to the end of this section. We got more sections left in this chapter 10. And we, until he finally meets Sri Yukteswar, we're ready to end this here. And unless anyone else wants to add something. And thank you, all the listeners. And thank you, Priyank and Lauren.
Thank you.